Hey, it's Erin and Jen with the Broken Vermont Podcast.
Are there any upcoming events or anything that we should tell people about?
Yeah, one thing I do need to tell people, if you are BIPOC living in Vermont, the VTPOC BIPOC Community Survey is open until June 26th. So it would be really helpful if all BIPOC people completed that survey so we know how best to serve you, and then also how we can push the Vermont government on serving the BIPOC community in Vermont.
In other news, the White River Conservation District, in partnership with the Center for Grassroots Organizing, is hosting a summer series we're calling Dirt and Democracy. Every other Sunday, starting June 9th from 5:30 to 7 p.m., join us online or at in-person watch parties throughout Vermont to learn from agrarian movement leaders from across the globe. This summer series focuses on building a democratic agrarian social movement informed by all of us.
Okay. I forgot our intro.
We don't have one
yet. Okay, but anyway.
Welcome
back. The Broken Vermont Podcast is Erin and Jen.
Jen and Erin.
And we have a very special guest. Kat Hudson is here. One of our favorite people, actually.
Oh.
Truthfully.
Yeah, actually.
It's great to be here.
Yeah,
I've never been to this amazing space. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of Broken Vermont.
Woohoo! Love to hear that.
Can you please introduce yourself?
Yes, I am Kat Buxton. I live in Sharon, and I am a soil geek. I like to play with plants and bugs and all the places where they dwell and talk incessantly about that.
Total geek.
Geek squad.
Completely geeking out. That's awesome. We work, all three of us work together in various ways, so you're also a advocate.
I am an advocate. I do some community organizing. I like to work with kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm a composter. Mm-hmm. And play with plants in public spaces and invite other people to do the same. I wear a lot of hats and I keep pretty busy, and I'm a beginning farmer.
Yeah.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your farm?
Yes. Our farm is called Birch Forest Farm. We're not selling anything yet. We are building our infrastructure, which a lot of that is building soil. It's a forest farm, so we have a little acre that's cleared inside of a 20-acre forest plot, and we're still figuring out what we're going to do, but it's likely fruit and nuts, native plants, mushrooms. And I'm really working on dry beans. I don't know that we'll ever have enough to sell, but I'll be really happy when I can grow all the dry beans I eat in a year.
More beans.
And I love
more local beans.
Yes. Love growing beans.
Yeah.
I love eating beans.
Me too. Mm-hmm. Me too. And they're like little jewels inside their little shells.
Yeah,
and
they're so fun to open.
It's like the best thing in November to sit and open all your bean shells, sort them by color. I love it.
Can't wait till November.
Coming to look at some beans.
Yeah. Awesome. When did you get activated? Like, what in your life made you be like, soil or politics, democracy, community building?
I'm not sure. It's kind of always been steeped in. Certainly didn't come from my family. I wasn't really raised to be aware. But I couldn't help it. When I was 23, 100 years ago.
That's right, 123 years ago.
My husband and I rode our bicycles across the country for 3 years.
Whoa.
And we camped in between, like, 3 or 4 month stints we would work, but we camped the whole way. And on that trip, I did that instead of college. And it totally shifted who I am and how I wanted to interact with the world. We did that trip to kind of get away from people. But it turns out that it was a really social experience. And I met a lot of different people and saw a lot of different landscapes and saw a lot of trash and devastated environments and devastated communities. Mm-hmm. And it, yeah, it made me want to focus more on being a community member. Mm-hmm. So when we landed back here in Vermont, I just kind of dove right in. I think I started out working at the farmer's market. Mm. I was swinging a lot of little jobs, and the farmer's market was one. And that's how I kind of started to get to know farmers and really started diving into how food is grown. And when I learned it had to do with microbes, man, that just set me down a wormhole that I can't seem to get out of.
You said the special word. We talked about microbes all day yesterday. Oh my gosh. One thing I learned yesterday is that there are up to 9 billion microbes on one seed, like in the seed.
It's so mind-blowing.
More than there are people on Earth, there's more microbes in one seed.
Yeah.
And that the seed, like, you know, starts with them, like similar to how we're born with gut, you know, microbial activity happening in our bodies, that they need them, and then they like exude them into the soil and then like eat them back up, and then the soil, you know, just it's
regurgitation.
Just
it's the best, insane. Right?
Yeah. Completely insane.
That's so awesome. You spent the day with one of my heroes yesterday.
Oh my gosh, the soil queen.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, Christine Jones from New Zealand.
Dr. Christine Jones.
Wow.
One of my favorite talks from her is about quorum sensing.
Yeah.
Quorum sensing in the soil microbiome. Right. And it might sound like a long, boring title, but man, it's so worth checking out. And she compares the human gut to the soil microbiome, the human microbiome, and it's all connected. And yeah, one thing that really stands out from that concept of quorum sensing is just that once we get a certain amount of diversity of organisms, everything starts working in ways that we really don't even understand yet. Mm-hmm. It just blows my mind.
Right.
Yeah, the places that I'm super interested in are the ones that we know so little about, like soil, mm-hmm. our gut, the universe, the oceans, the human brain. We know nothing about these things, but we proceed as if we know everything.
They're so complicated and also like perfectly organized.
Chaotically perfect,
chaotically
right?
Chaotically designed perfectly.
Yeah.
Could you talk, just to explain a little bit more about that, like the microbes, what about the microbes? What about, and if you want to take it to quorum sensing, I mean, that's fine. But
well, so I have this little thing I do with kids and adults, and it's called Sunshine to Soil Aggregate. And it's one of the most exciting pathways to sort of describe. And so it starts with photosynthesis. You know, the sun, thank goodness we have the sun. You know, we've got photosynthesis, taking carbon dioxide, among other things, out of the air, bringing it down to plants, where plants have these amazing panels, like the first solar panels, right? All within plant leaves that have amazing mechanisms that can take sunlight and take carbon chains and turn them into sugars, which then they know to invest, like something like 50% of the energy that's taken in from the sun goes down into the plant, goes through the plant pathways and through the root system and creates these exudates. And one of my other mentors, Dr. Elaine Ingham, refers to these as the cakes and cookies.
Cute.
Right?
It's better than the snot, which is what Dee Dee calls them.
Well, I do talk about snots. I like to call them goos, glues, snots, and slimes. When I work with little kids, they know those words. They're like, goos, glues, snots, and slimes. They'll chant it for me. I get pretty excited about that. So then these exudates are attracting certain organisms. And there's this amazing magic that happens where certain organisms like certain exudates that are produced by certain plants. And then those microbes go and get certain minerals from the soil that the plant needs. And there's all this selective intelligence that happens under our feet all the time. And that's how plants eat. So, you know, a lot of people think that we got to have plastic bottles and bags of things in order for plants to get their food. Mm-hmm. But that's not how nature does it. You know, nobody's walking through the forest with a bag of fertilizer. Thank goodness. So when we have a diversity of plants, and we don't quite know what that number is, and I don't think there's any specific number because context is really important. So what's true in the Falkland Islands may not be true in California, may not be true in Alaska or Africa or Sweden, et cetera, right? So everywhere in the world has their own diverse selection of beings that can live. And when we reach that maximum diversity, all of the mechanisms of food cycling happens, nutrient cycling happens. And from that, you know, I just call it magic because it gets over my head pretty quick. I just know that it's more amazing than we even need to understand.
Right.
And it brings about a reverence. Mm-hmm. And a need to protect and enable conditions. So I try to think of myself as someone who tries to enable the conditions for people to love our planet and all of the amazing functions that we don't know about, but we rely on every single day. So the sunshine to soil aggregate, I should talk about what a soil aggregate is,
because
not everyone's a geek like me. But simply put, if you've ever been in a garden or you've ever pulled a plant out of the ground, hopefully a little bit gently, and you get the root system with the plant, you'll see these little chunks of soil that are attached to root systems, and they're attached by the goos, glues, snots, and slimes that these microbes are producing. And those little chunks of soil are called soil aggregates. And inside of those are billions and billions of little organisms and all the goos and glues that help to hold it together. There's a lot of air in there. It's where water can pass through it. So it's these little aerobic, air-filled areas in soil. And it's actually plants building soil right before your eyes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mentioned on our farm, we're building soil. So what we're doing is trying to grow a diverse range of plants everywhere we can and give them what they need, enabling those conditions for those plants to build soil so that we can continue to grow more and more plants and increase diversity in our habitat.
And soil's not dirt.
Soil's not dirt. Dirt is what you...
I'm kind of...
I've got dirt under my fingernails and on the bottom of my shoe. Dirt is dead and soil is so alive.
So these aggregates, not only are they like full of nutrients, but they also, they hold onto water, right?
Very importantly.
They have little pockets of oxygen too, right?
They allow for water to infiltrate, so to pass through soil and then, be held like a sponge. So our good friend Dee Dee talks a lot about the soil sponge. And, you know, it's really, if you envision a sponge and all those little air holes in it, that's what soil should be like. And when we have diversity of plants and microbes all doing that work, that's what soil is like. When we disturb our environment repeatedly, we squish all those air spaces out, create compaction, totally changes the way that water flows through landscapes, totally changes the flow of exudates, and the ability of microbes to do their magic.
I saw Dee Dee do her bread and flour example for the first time ever last Friday. I've seen other people do it, which I think she came up with it.
But, she did,
And I'm going to post it to our Instagram. I have videos of both phases of it. But when Dee Dee did it, she said something that was so important. And I actually, the first time I ever like saw it done was on like, you know, Kiss the Ground, this movie, their Instagram, they were like, Dee Dee Purse House, you know, invented this little, I don't know what you would call it.
Exercise, activity.
Activity. Where basically you pour water onto, you know, a pile of flour and you see how the water washes over it and the flour obviously washes away, but then not all the flour even gets wet. Like underneath it's like bone dry. And then you do the same thing, but on like a few slices of bread. And it's so cute because she like sticks plants in the bread and like little like Monopoly houses.
I use Monopoly houses, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, but what she said was so important because she said, what is the difference between flour and water and bread?
Yeast.
And yeast is a microbe.
Yeah. Yeah,
I was like, okay, I'm sold.
I'm done.
Totally.
You got me now. Thank you. This is what I needed.
When I work with little kids, I teach soil science at Thetford Elementary School to fifth and sixth graders, and we start out with flour and bread. That's the first thing we do. And then we can refer back to that throughout the whole course. And when I teach gardening classes to adults, we start out with flour and bread. It's such a brilliant exercise. I mean, Dee Dee is... she's an amazing thinker. That activity has been done all over the world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what language you speak. It totally works. People understand mm-hmm. compaction. They understand the ability of microbes and how it changes everything when we have life in the soil.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to point out with the flower portion is that we have... and we're seeing this here in Vermont and in other places where we can have flooding and drought in the same place at the same time. So when you don't have soil structure, you can get a ton of rain and nobody gets a drink. Mm-hmm. It just rushes off and feeds our ocean dead zones, taking all the goos, not the good goos, mm-hmm. but the human goos, the toxic goos that we sort of bring with us everywhere, all end up in our waterways and just increase those ocean dead zones, which have grown in size every year that I've been alive.
Sure do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's an extension. You can talk about so many things using that exercise as a opener.
I like to picture her. She said she's done it on Wall Street. She's done it like yep. in India. She's like, show it to your friends, show it to your enemies.
Great dinner party trick. Yeah. It's
watch
wonderful.
This, everyone.
Yeah. And it's best to use the cheapest bread around.
Right.
Note it.
Yeah.
That can be someone's science experiment right there. Need a science project? Mm-hmm. We just told you one.
Yeah, there you go, kids.
Super good. I have lots of videos of kids performing that.
Yeah.
Because that's one, you know, we start off our soil science unit with it, but then they have to do a project, and oftentimes they'll choose to demonstrate soil and bread and write it all out and explain why it's important for our schoolyard to understand the flour and bread.
So... how would you explain composting to someone who has no idea what it is?
I should be able to answer that easily because I talk about compost all the time. And I'll have to tell you about my super compost project.
Yes, please.
but first, so composting it's really biomimicry, right? So biomimicry is copying life. and we see decomposition happen all around us and we're like, hey, we can do that and we can improve that because humans, you know, we think we can improve everything. But in terms of composting, we actually do accelerate the process of decomposition by understanding how decomposition happens and then recreating the environment that decomposition needs and speeding it up. And composting always includes air. If it doesn't have air, then it's really just a rotting pile of matter. So it really is decomposition can happen naturally all over the place. It happens in landfills. And the big difference are the microbes that are activated that you're creating the conditions for. So aerobic organisms are ones that like air, aerobic, and anaerobic are those that really don't need a lot of air. Some like air, some don't. And they're the organisms that create the stink. So ammonia, sulfur, et cetera, like all the smells that come out of rotting piles of food are from anaerobic organisms. They're also the ones that create the smells in landfills, and also methane, which doesn't smell but is a powerful heat-trapping gas. So composting is mimicking decomposition in an accelerated aerobic way that is controlled, and it's cycling nutrients in place. It's, you know, you asked earlier, how did I get started in all this? And actually, waste is kind of a big part of it. I've always been just floored by the waste. When I was 17 years old, some friends of mine and I started with our select person called the Sunshine Committee. We would, every Sunday, we'd go pick up trash on the side of the road, and we'd like meticulously sort it into what could be recycled and what couldn't be recycled.
Wow.
And that was sort of one of my first forays into like, wow, you can actually make a difference in this world. Mm-hmm. And people notice. And we got a free pass to the dump so that we could not have to pay to pick up the side of the road. I just got myself distracted into the Sunshine Committee, but we were talking about compost.
We love a good rant, though.
Yeah, so really, you know, we live in such a wasteful, extractive world. And that's landed us in the sixth greatest extinction and a climate emergency and all the other things you guys talk about in broken Vermont. There's a lot of broken, right? Because of our behavior. But managing our waste is sort of, to me, it's a really tangible way to make a difference in your life, in your yard, in your community, and in the world. Because it helps us to shift our behavior and our culture to one that is more aware of what we're using, what we need. So composting is recycling nutrients in place. And ideally, you're putting those right back into a growing environment. You can certainly use them in your garden and grow great food. They can go on the farm. They can go in a lawn to help a lawn become healthier. Not that I'm a huge fan of lawns, but there are uses for lawns. You know, I like to roll around in the grass and sports are fun. And I wish we had a lot less lawn, but compost is... it's needed, it's necessary, and it's really easy, really forgiving, really accessible. And if you don't cycle your own nutrients in place, you're probably paying twice, once to get rid of your nutrients, to ship them off to someone else who likely isn't going to manage them with the same kind of love and responsibility and care for our environment, and create lots of pollution streams along the way. And then on the other hand, if you garden at all, you're buying compost. Mm-hmm. So now you've got two waste streams that you're supporting when you could have just cycled your nutrients in place.
Wow. I mean, it makes the Vermont composting law make sense.
We could talk about that.
Yeah.
I think we'd love to, yeah.
Act 148.
Okay.
Yeah.
Universal recycling law.
Yep.
Well-intended, unfunded, unenforceable. But still, we have managed to actually make a difference throughout the state, largely because of people who are trying to make it work.
Right, right. People who actually care about it. Mm-hmm. Can you briefly say what the law actually is? Or do you have it pulled up?
Okay, so Vermont state law bans disposal of food scraps in the trash or landfills. Food scraps include pre- and post-consumer food waste that is derived from processing or discarding of food and that is able to be used, though one of the following options: food donation for people in need, animal feed, composting, and digestion, anaerobic digestion. So, yeah, so...
so you can't throw food out in the trash.
That's right. However, if you do, no one will catch you or say anything.
Right. Like,
but okay.
But what if you're a restaurant or like an institution? Yeah. How are they doing with this?
So the way the law was rolled out, it took 5 years, and they started with the largest institutions, so the largest food producers, and then on down to finally individual households. So hospitals and colleges, and then restaurants and schools, and then households. So you have to pay, essentially. It's kind of a regressive tax, right? It's not an actual tax, but there are some places where you can cycle your nutrients for free if you're savvy, or if there's someone around that's collecting them, but you still have to bring them there, right? So it's created more work for people. I think it's worth it because behavior change and culture change is something we really need. And we all eat every day, and we all produce waste every day. So if we can change the way that we work around that and manage it, we actually could be changing our behavior and culture in a way that is beneficial to all life, not just people. It costs money though. So restaurants have to hire typically a hauler. So there are a number of small scale entrepreneurs that are collecting food waste and then bringing them either back to their own site or to a local farm, and they're composting in local communities. Some of those are like around here in Bradford. A lot of the folks hire Bob Sandberg out of Corinth. I can't remember the name of his farm right now. Cookville Compost. And he's been picking up waste from restaurants and schools for a long time, even before the law, because he knows it's the right thing to do. And then he turns around and sells compost to gardeners. So there are quite a few haulers in our region that can do that. And then there's one big hauler in our region that does that. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that you never quite know where their food scraps are going. They charge a lot of money. I'm working with schools right now and actually trying to figure out how much they're spending. And it's really interesting because most schools have no idea how much they're spending to hire this one big company because their bills are really vague. So that's pretty interesting.
And do they pick up other stuff as well?
They do. They do. This company picks up all the waste. And they supposedly have a way of separating, and sometimes there are two trucks in a row. Yeah. One is managing food waste. Now, I have a lot of negative things to say about this company, but at the same time, they were forced into having to deal with this, right? Like they had to invest a lot of money. They had to figure out what to do. It wasn't easy. So kudos for them for even trying.
For figuring. Yeah. It says we have more than 20 haulers offer food scrap collection. And it's currently required by law for bag drop haulers. So, yeah, A&R has a nice website.
If you can get around on it, it's there's some great information up there. But, man, that website can be challenging to find anything.
Yeah, let's see. Take down your bird feeders, composting in bear country. You do not compost meat and bones at home. So I guess I need to get in my car and drive somewhere to drop my meat and bones off, which I'm pretty sure a lot of us eat meat on a daily. So thanks for that inconvenience.
Why is that? Can you talk about that? Do you compost meat and bones?
Yes, I do. I don't eat meat, but I compost with a whole bunch of schools, and all meat and bones go in the compost. So I understand why they're doing that, why they're telling people not to compost meat in the backyard, largely because of those little organisms I talked about, the aerobic and anaerobic organisms. Meat is dense protein, and it takes longer to break down, and it just needs the right recipe. So you need to have enough feedstocks or other ingredients like hay, sawdust, straw, leaves, etc. Those are all considered high carbon ingredients, and they help to balance out the high nitrogen ingredient that meat brings in. So as they slowly decompose, they often anaerobic conditions are created, and then you get those smells, and then wildlife comes in. So one of the reasons to not compost meat and bones in the backyard is to protect wildlife so that we're not creating conditions for wildlife to come in and cause a nuisance and then get shot or something, right? Or sick. But I would like to see a world where we all understand the really basic processes of composting, because if you can get the recipe right, then you get heat. Like we're talking 150, 160 degrees inside the compost bin. Meat doesn't stand a chance. And it's not going to stink. So, you know, in our school garden at Thetford Elementary School, one of our favorite pastimes with the kids is they pull out all the chicken bones. We've got chicken bones in all of our gardens. And I just had, they're so cute. They're like, can I bring it home?
Sure, why not?
I'm like, nah, I don't think mom and dad are going to appreciate bones in your pockets when you come home. So let's just dig a hole and bury those because they slow release nutrients into our garden with the help of microbes. Those microbes can mine the calcium and magnesium and other nutrients from these bones and bring them up to plants. So it's important to do it right. I think people are smart and can figure out how to compost meat and bones. So unlike the government, I think the government tries to dumb everything down so that, I don't know. I mean, I guess I get it, but I think people are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And this is a really basic, it's a really basic process, composting and recycling our nutrients is a really basic process that we should be better at.
So what can you compost?
You can compost everything that nature makes. Anything that's considered organic, and I don't mean like organic in terms of organic farming, but just organic materials. So anything that comes from trees, anything that comes from plants, grasses, including every single kind of food that you can think of.
What about flowers?
Yep, flowers can go in there too. Sometimes people will tell you not to put flowers in your compost. And the reason they're saying that is because oftentimes flowers might have diseases or fungus on them. And if you don't have a balanced compost recipe and you don't have the heat and you don't have the billions of microbes, aerobic microbes doing the work, then those funguses, which are pathogens, could persist in a compost pile and then create problems with your finished product. And the same is true for all the things they say not to put in your compost. They'll say, don't put citrus in there. Well, citrus decomposes. It totally does. But citrus, we have these cleaners that are citrus based because they're antimicrobial, right? Microbes are who we're attracting to our compost bin. That's who we want to do all this work, these aerobic organisms. But so in order for citrus to compost, it needs to volatilize those compounds that are antimicrobial before it can decompose. The same is true with pine. I've heard so many people say like, oh, you can't compost pine, or you can't compost oak leaves or walnut leaves.
What is the forest floor?
I know. I'm like, if we couldn't compost oak leaves, we would be like swimming through feet and feet of like leaves in the forest. Like decomposition happens. How can you say you can't compost that? And I think honestly that part of the reason why people don't compost is they're confused by all of these mixed messages. And the only rule is that you have to have the right recipe to enable the conditions for aerobic organisms to do their work, and they create heat in the process. So if you can get that recipe right, you can compost all of it.
Mm-hmm. And how do you know you have the right recipe? It's a mixture of things.
A thermometer is your best friend, just like a standard meat thermometer, but they make compost thermometers. I've got them in all sizes.
If you need a thermometer, just call Kat.
And your thermometer will tell you of the heat activity in your compost pile, and the heat is generated by microbes. So it doesn't, you don't have to have sun in order to compost. Mm-hmm. That's another misnomer. People think they need a black plastic composter and it's got to be in full sun. You can do that, but I prefer to use my full sun to grow food. And my compost is actually in a shady spot where I'm not growing food because the heat comes from within. The heat comes from within your compost pile when you get that balanced recipe, which is essentially three parts carbon to one part nitrogen. And for simplicity's sake, consider all your food scraps nitrogen, and then your feedstocks, which can be leaves or hay or paper. We should talk about that one. Straw, wood chips, any kind of woody product at all. And particle size matters. You're trying to recreate that sort of sponge-like environment. But so for every bucket of food scraps, doesn't matter if it's a yogurt container or a 5-gallon bucket, you've got one bucket of food scraps, then you're going to have three buckets of these carbon materials. They're called browns, they're called dries, they're called carbon. They're all talking about these sort of woody plant-based products that the life has left. So if your grass clippings are still green, throw those in with your food scraps. But if they've turned brown, now you've got a feedstock. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't matter what color they are. You're just looking for the life to have left. And lots of air comes in with those. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important part of the recipe. So 3-to-1, three browns or carbons or feedstocks to one food scraps. And the other thing I like to say is, so for those three buckets of feedstocks, you're not like punching down the hay to make it so that it's as much hay as you can fit in a bucket. You want all the air that comes with it too. So it's three buckets by volume, not by weight or even mass.
Very helpful.
Yeah. So how does one start to compost at home? How easy or hard is it?
It's super easy. I have a YouTube video up there that everyone can look at for free called Compost 101, where I sort of break it down.
Cool. We'll link it.
Yeah.
And yeah, like watch that. I think it has everything you need. It's a workshop I've been hosting for many, many years, and I just finally put it up on YouTube. And when people want to hire me, I'm like, are you sure? Because you could just go check it for free over here.
kind of you.
Well, knowledge should be free, right?
Like, I don't know anyone who turns down money as much as Kat. Right.
You know, money is
like, I'm too busy.
It's a tool. Money's a tool, but it's caused so many problems. And I think some things should just be free, like knowledge. Why do we keep knowledge locked up and inaccessible? Like, if we know something, it should be shared. So I think anybody can learn how to compost. And the first thing you want to do is get some feedstocks. I recommend getting them in place. We live in an area of the world where, like, October, November, they're abundant. So rake those leaves up, take your dried grass clippings. I often go to horse farms and get old hay because horses are really picky and they like only perfect hay. Mm-hmm. And people who raise horses often end up with a bunch of hay that their horses aren't going to eat, and it's
like
no good.
Moldy hay is perfect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Rotty, moldy, doesn't matter. I like to try and make sure that the higher uses for ingredients are considered before we use them for composting. So Erin, you had read off what's called the food recovery hierarchy from the website there. And the first thing we should do is waste less. The second thing we should do is make sure that people are fed. The third thing we should do is make sure animals are fed. And then we make compost. Even though I'm a geek, I want compost all the time, everywhere. There are higher uses for those calories that should be considered before we make compost. And then after composting is creating methane energy, using those anaerobic organisms in a controlled environment to make methane, capture it, and then create energy with it.
I would love to hear about your super compost project.
Yeah, me too.
Can you tell us all the deets?
I can. Yeah. It's pretty exciting. Yeah. So in 2022, I had an idea to get schools composting. I've been a consultant with schools for years, and many schools have hired me to try and get composting going at their school, but there are a million barriers to why it doesn't work at schools. Usually, pretty much all have to do with human behavior. And, you know, schools are stressed. They got a lot of things on their plate. Yeah. They're expected to be everything these days with very little resources. And it's a challenge. And so kudos and praise to all the teachers and school administrators out there. Like, I see you. I hear you.
Amen.
I love you. You're doing great work. So after many years of trying to do this with schools, I sort of made a list of all the barriers. Like, here's all the reasons why it's not working. And I emailed six.
You made a broken things list?
I did.
Oh my God.
Can you share it with us?
I absolutely can.
I'd love to know the broken things.
List them off. We got sound effects.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a big fan of the grassroots, right? Like things happen from the grassroots, and that's where community is born and where it grows and where real change happens. But we also live in a society where there's like this top-down pressure. So I decided that I would email six superintendents, all in the Upper Valley. And this was in June, like right after school ended. And I couldn't believe within 3 days, all of them got back to me, which blew me away. And I emailed them and I said, listen, I have this idea. I want to bring composting to schools. We want to do it regionally because one of the reasons schools don't succeed at it is schools are like in this little vacuum and they're insular. They're not really reaching out to other schools. They don't have time for it. There's a million reasons. But I thought if a lot of schools are doing this at once, it gives us an opportunity to learn from each other, to share volunteers, to share ideas, to share feedstock sources, to connect with farms, to get food scraps off to farms, to do a sort of regional wide, like, can we all reduce waste? Can we learn from each other that way? Following that same hierarchy of reduce waste, feed people, feed animals, then make compost. And they thought it was a good idea. So I was like, cool. We're going to call it the Super Compost Project because it started with supervisory unions. So okay. That's how the super came. And then of course, like super compost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? I picture you in a cape every time I hear it.
I want somebody to draw me like a little protozoa with a cape on. Yes. That would be awesome.
We can make that doable. Easy. Like, that's easy.
AI can do it.
Yeah.
We know you love AI.
Oh, I'm trying. I got one hand up for sure. All but
right. We still need artists.
Yeah. So from there, five of the six superintendents said yes. Hartford opted out. And I've heard from parents and teachers that they wish they had opted in.
Yeah.
So maybe in the future they'll come back. And, you know, all schools have insane turnover, again, for 1,000 reasons, right. Including at the superintendent level. So I think that that no had something to do with like other tumultuous things so happening things in the school system that they had to attend to. Yeah. So two supervisory unions in Windsor, the Orange East Supervisory Union, which includes Bradford, the White River Valley Supervisory Union, and Rivendell Supervisory Union all said yes. And then we have one outlier school that is Twinfield. It's up in Plainfield, Marshfield, Vermont. And they're on board. They're a K through 12 school. So right now I have 20 schools that have said yes. From that point of the supervisory unions, the superintendent set me up with a meeting with the administrators for all the schools in their supervisory union. I presented to them, and from there, each school decided yes or no. And that was 2 years ago. So then once we said, okay, at the time we had 24 schools that said yes, then we started looking for funding.
Yep.
And we got some small grants from some private foundations to get us started. And we just received a federal grant, the Community Food Waste Reduction Program, from the USDA. Mm-hmm. And so that just started June 1st.
Right.
And we got almost $400,000 from that. So that is enabling us to pay for these systems. The Super Compost Project will build a compost system or improve an existing system. Our full-scale system is a 16-by-20-foot pavilion put on top of hard-pack surfacing. So we'll go in, we'll make the groundwork because you don't want to do it on a hard, impervious surface because if there should be any leachate, which is the liquid waste that could come from a compost system if your recipe is off, and it happens, we don't want to create any problems for fish or anybody else. So we make sure that we have a pervious surface underneath. 16 by 20 foot pavilion with a three bin system underneath that are made out of hemlock. And our design is really built to make sure that plenty of air is coming in. It's animal proof. So we put in the system, or we improve an existing system. Mm-hmm. With sometimes it's a door on the front or a roof on top so that you can have moisture control. Mm-hmm. Also, schools compost mostly in the wintertime. So we want to make sure that it's accessible and it's not like an awful job that you're out there freezing and wet, right? Or that you have to shovel the compost first. So really just trying to make the systems work as an outdoor classroom. Mm-hmm. The 16 by 20 pavilion's awesome because it's enough room for a whole class to be under there and to be dry and not be on top of each other. So we're billing these as an extension of your classroom. It's an outdoor classroom. It comes with, me to start.
You get Kat.
Yeah. So first I come in and I just help to sort of connect the dots, that social mycelium within the school, mm-hmm. of like, how do people connect with each other? How do they relate with one another? Where are the personality issues? Where are the breakdown in system issues? Identifying those and working to correct those. And then when a school feels like they're ready, and we've got all kinds of checklists to know when schools are ready, then we site a system, we build it, and then they get 2 years of technical expertise. Once their system is in place, we hire a team of technical service providers. We're going to be hiring soon, folks. And each school will get a TSP, technical service provider, that is also working with 4 to 6 other schools that are geographically close. So really trying to build in that school connectivity, shared farm, shared resources, with a community school sort of model. There will be curriculum to come with it. Right now we are sort of tracking all of the amazing curriculum that's already been developed, that's out there, trying to find where are the gaps, how do we make these more accessible to people. A lot of times people who make curriculum don't really get that you've got like 35 minutes to deliver a lesson to mm-hmm. students. So really trying to make that happen too. In the end, we will develop a toolkit. It will be available for free online. Great. With everything that you need to start this in your region. So we're hoping that this pilot project of regional composting at schools mm-hmm. will be able to travel everywhere.
It's awesome.
Yes.
You didn't mention microscopes, but I know you got microscopes.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah. You know, and every school is different, of course. But as soon as I get an inkling that there's somebody interested in geeking out through a microscope at a school, we're definitely connecting them with the New Hampshire Academy of Science mm-hmm. at Crossroads Academy mm-hmm. because they're incredible. It's a wonderful lab. I could say so many good things about them. One of the things they do is they have high-powered microscopes that they loan to schools.
The highest.
Yeah.
Like in the world.
Yeah. Like you need 400X to be able to see mm-hmm. bacteria even pop up as a little spot on your slide. Mm-hmm. So the ultimate is that, you know, in my mind anyway, is that schools will start teaching soil science yeah. because this is a place that humans need to know more. Mm-hmm. We think we know, I don't even know how they come up with this, but we think we know that less than 10% of what there is to know about the soil biome. So like when you know that little, how do you even know you know that little? I don't know, but we're learning new things all the time about yeah. soil microbes. And I really think that it could be an incredible field for yeah. people to go into. And so the other thing that New Hampshire Academy of Science does that I'm a big promoter of is they offer programming, summer programming for mm-hmm. students doing real science. I mean, this is not play science. They're like right. mapping the DNA of the lady slipper, for
Correct.
Instance, right?
That's what my daughter did.
Yeah, incredible stuff. So what an incredible asset. And they have a lot of funding. So like people in grades 9 through 12 can go and get summer programming free.
6 through 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great.
And I think they have a 5th grade like onboarding program.
Yeah.
And they run a program out of this, the space on Main as well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're so great. Cool. So another part of the Super Compost Project is sort of developing this community of practice. We think of it in concentric circles. So inside the school, we've got the school compost team, which ideally includes food service and maintenance, not to do the work, but because they are obviously involved. And we really try to design this project to make sure that everyone who's impacted is at the table making decisions from the very beginning. Mm. And food service and maintenance are impacted by every decision at a school, often not included. Right. And without them, where would we be? Like, these are the people that feed us and keep the place hygienic and know how everything works. Right. And where everything is. So including them in the process as much as they want to be. And that looks different every school. Some are like, I want nothing to do with this. Others are like, I love composting. I'll run it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then administrators, teachers, and ideally students as well on that compost team. So that's the inner circle. Then the next circle out is your technical service provider, potentially the Master Composter Program of Vermont, local farmers, foresters, sawyers, people who produce feedstocks that are otherwise waste products to them, community volunteers, the local food pantry, New Hampshire Academy of Sciences, et cetera. And that goes into like the third circle out is like the community of practice. Where might you sell your compost? Or what are other programs regionally? This starts to get into like all the other schools are in that sort of third concentric circle. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to build a connected community around recycling our waste into something magical and necessary.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I know. You're doing all the great things.
It's so fun.
You should come visit me. I just throw my stuff outside. But you want to know what? I am Cinderella at this
Erin
point.
Is actually Cinderella.
My foxes are well fed. My squirrels are also well fed. I have all of the birds that you can think of. I have hummingbirds now, so I have to go get a hummingbird feeder for my hummingbirds because I've counted like six now. So I'm getting there. My deer are happy. They just like come in my yard now and just eat. So like I'm in my Cinderella moment. So I'm really afraid to compost because then like, what if my animals don't want to like come talk to me?
Oh, they'll still come talk.
Okay. Cause my foxes are like really thriving right
now. She raised a whole fox family.
I have a mom, a dad, and eight cubs. And like, I just cut up food and I go as close as I can to them and just drop it off. So. And now they're coming closer into my yard. So that's the only reason I'm like, my animals. So, yeah, I should do better. I need to do better. And also, wildlife is thriving in my backyard. So.
We just got a set date. I'll come help you.
Okay, thank you.
I just have to say that. While I love your Cinderella story, it's not the best for wildlife to encourage them to be reliant on humans because we suck.
We do, but I don't.
You don't. You do not suck.
So,
but collectively as a species, we're just not kind.
We're not kind.
They can't rely on humans, but they can rely on Erin.
They can rely on me.
And you're feeding good food.
I am, like bell peppers and like berries.
And then when they're done with you, they go like, over to Cedar Circle Farm.
They do,
and
exactly.
Nibble off their fields.
I didn't have a lot of mice.
There's always like half a pineapple in her yard and like...
And I saw
a melon.
I just saw like a whole squirrel gang eating my mangoes. It was cutest thing. So that brings me joy to like go outside, drink my coffee, and just watch the animals feast from my yard.
That is pretty sweet.
It is. So I'm in that Cinderella moment right now. So I mean, I am going to compost.
Not going to ruin it for you, right?
Because I am doing something illegal. Like I need to not do that. So need to compost. So everyone, you should compost because it's a law.
It is the law. Wow. And that does help when I'm talking with schools.
Yeah.
It's one of the first things I remind them that it is the law.
Yeah.
That helps
them be eager to hire you.
Come on.
I mean, in terms of like the household composting, so you said there was this 5-year rollout of the law.
Yep.
And it finally trickled down to households. So we're there now. Did they like give everybody a bucket? to put their food scraps in? Or
no, if you happen to live in one of the areas with an active solid waste management district, you may have gotten buckets for free. Or you may have been offered a backyard composting workshop for free where you could get a composter or other sort of larger plastic things at a discounted rate. I did a series of backyard composting workshops with the Greater Upper Valley Solid Waste Management District for a few years, getting ready for the program to roll out. So certainly some people have started composting in their backyard. Some people are just using a pile. Some are building wooden bins. There's a million different kinds of bins that you can use. The Solid Waste Management District's promoted these plastic bins, which I'm not a big fan of. But they work if you do it well. They're better for maybe suburbia, which we're not. And there are green cones. And so there are a bunch of different things that you can use, and I'm happy to talk about any of those. But a lot of transfer stations, so around here we've got these transfer stations because we only have one landfill in the state of Vermont. It's up by Coventry, polluting Lake
Fermagog.
Causing some pretty big problems up in that lake. So and it's
Canadian
the only one.
Drinking water supply.
Right. Perfect.
But it's not America's, so we don't regulate it like drinking water.
And I'm sure the folks who live around that lake are, you know, pretty tired of it at this point. I know they're constantly advocating for better practices of management of the ecosystem up there. But so to try and keep the landfill going, the transfer stations all collect recycling, collect trash, and many of them now have like a wheelie tote, plastic wheelie tote, where you can bring all your food waste, including meat and bones. And some people who compost in their backyards will just bring their meat and bones to the transfer center so that they can stay out of the trash. And then from the transfer center, they can go to a bunch of different places. Some transfer stations will hire a hauler. Others have people in their community that come and collect and then compost it at home or, you know, on their farm or something like that. So it is helping to keep the nutrients more local, potentially. But some of those are being shipped off to Maine and, you know, ground with plastic, for example. Some are being shipped to the Lebanon landfill where they're actually making compost, but not any compost you'd want to use in your garden. They don't mine trash with it. And they're meeting, there's like an EPA mandate saying that you have to cover your the active part of your landfill. I think it might be every day or maybe it's every week. Can't quite remember. And a lot of landfills will bring in material to do that. Lebanon is taking food waste and creating compost on site to produce that. So in the big scale,
layering it on top of
the big scale, it's better than shipping off to Maine and grinding it with plastic. But one of the schools I just picked up is Marion Cross School in Norwich, elementary school. They had been using the one company to pick up their food waste.
And I know what this one company is. Well, so I'm pretty sure
we know what it is.
when the school students did a research project to find out like what happens to our waste, and they discovered that it was going to the Lebanon landfill to make compost and stay in the landfill. And they felt like, wow, that was really disappointing. That's not what they wanted to learn. So they asked to be a part of the Super Compost Project so that they could compost on site and cycle their waste right into their own school garden.
You're doing some amazing things. Just want you to know that. No one told you today. I just did.
Thank you, Erin.
You're welcome. Just want you to know.
Right. Wow. Landfills. What about plastic in compost? Like what? I know you think about stickers on bananas and things of the sort.
It would be really good as a part of that behavior and culture change, right? To recognize, like, this is plastic and it will be here for your, you know, great-grandchildren, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren down the road. And this is food waste that can be recycled, you know, in a few weeks into a nice, healthy soil amendment. So we call that source separation. And it's one of the first things I do at schools is go in and help improve the source separation So actually removing fruit stickers and all the other plastic. So like the top of the bananas often are wrapped in plastic or yogurt cups, things like that. If they go in your compost, they will be there when you turn your compost. You'll have this whole pile that's like looks like soil ready to go in your garden, and there will be plastic bits. You can even still scan the UPC code on that fruit sticker because the microbes will actually clean it. It comes out super clean, and you can scan it. I have literally seen those come out of the other side of a chicken and still be able to be scanned.
Oh,
we can just walk around with this scanner.
Chickens don't like fruit stickers. It is a choking hazard.
Thank you.
Yes. We really should be better at separating our trash out.
Nutritional value.
So that's the one part, right? Like is removing the trash from our nutrients so that we can recycle those. We need to get better at that. As you move up beyond the household and school scale, and you get these big haulers that are taking food waste from grocery stores and like the clamshell packaging with a sandwich in it that didn't get eaten, or it kills me to see often organic produce wrapped in plastic.
Yeah.
That's another thing, right?
And then they have this sign. And then they have this sign like, why is our organic produce wrapped in plastic? And it's to keep it fresh for you. Thank you. No, thank you.
I literally just bought some organic zucchini and it was like double wrapped in plastic. And I was like, oh, okay.
And the individually wrapped potatoes.
Oh, I have not seen that.
Oh,
really?
You don't want.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a sticker on it that's like, easy to cook. Just pop me in the microwave. Then remove the plastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Don't do that.
Yeah. Don't. You're eating plastic.
Yeah, we have a plastic problem.
We do. We need an episode on plastic.
Yeah, we've been wanting to talk to someone from a transfer station and something, get the lowdown, because it's not real recycling, really.
No, you know, and the recycling market is completely based on the commodities market. Like, what is the cost of fuel currently, and who needs the product to turn into something else? So it's constantly fluctuating. One thing the Universal Recycling Law did was help to streamline what can be recycled. Before that law went into place, every community had their own list of what could be recycled, which definitely did not help people have a good understanding. Like, it was super confusing. Now it's like you can recycle number one and number two plastic, period. Sometimes you can recycle number five. All the other recycling numbers are not, there's no market for those. So when you bring your plastics to a transfer station, oftentimes what happens is the community will hold all of that material, whether it's the glass, they've got a truck for glass, a truck for paper, a truck for plastics. Some of them have balers where they can bale it. And when they get a full truckload, then they can sell it to the commodities market. Mm-hmm. But if you've got bales of plastic and the commodities person comes to see that and they see a bunch of contamination, right in the ocean it goes. I mean, you know, they're not.
Or the landfill, like it'll just get treated as trash.
It's a phrase I use, like just throw it right in the ocean because it's going to the ocean dead zone anyway.
Yeah.
I think a lot of countries.
I'm not advocating for throwing things in the ocean, just to be clear.
I mean,
cut out the middleman.
Just,
so plastics are a problem, and now we have microplastics. They're everywhere. We know very little about them. Mm-hmm. Who wants to pay to get that research done? 3M, perhaps?
LOL.
Right? maybe right alongside the PFAS forever chemical research. So these are things that are often on my mind. We use paper products in recycling or in composting. Mm-hmm. I use cardboard to do layering to create
soil. What about
soil.
Those like quote unquote compostable plates and utensils?
Yeah. Quote unquote. it's a big problem in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, we eat every day. And I think we could plan for that and just bring a metal fork with you every day. Like, leave it in your glove box. Mm-hmm. Thrift stores have them. You can get lots of them.
My grandparents did that.
You know, so like bring a cloth napkin, bring a fork, bring a spoon, just have them around, have a cup. I got my glass bottle, right, of my flavored water.
What flavor is that? It
looks good. I use a little lemon juice, and today I used a little mango juice and a little ginger, and then just water. Delish. On really hot days, I throw a little salt in there.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite, but I'm also addicted to kombucha, and I buy glass bottles.
Yeah,
me too.
I should just make my own, but I haven't yet.
I'm not there yet. I probably would never be there, but I do enjoy buying it.
It's I so like yummy. That it comes in a glass bottle.
Yeah, the me lemon too. Berry is like by far my favorite one.
And two of our co-ops, Upper Valley Food Co-op and South Royalton Co-op, mm-hmm. have kombucha in bulk. You can bring your own bottle. Mm-hmm. And they're made locally.
I have so many bottles.
I do too. Because I mean to bring them back
me
and
too.
Fill them.
I have like 50 glass bottles. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do something with them one day.
Yeah.
But I do have to go, guys. I have a farmer I have to meet at the space. So, you guys can still chat without me. But we're going to meet Aaron out.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
I'm considering whether or not to, like right now I have schools taking their paper towels and using them as part of their ingredients for their compost. But I'm considering just taking that off the table because we don't know.
What is, yeah.
Yeah, the research hasn't been done. We know that especially paper products contain PFAS, but we absolutely. Don't know that all paper products do.
I think it's the white too, like the coloring is probably an issue. If you have like white paper towels.
I just learned that facial foundation makeup, PFAS.
Covered in PFAS. That's what makes it stick.
Yep.
Probably.
Another interesting thing gets right into plastics. You know, we all thought plastic straws are bad, right? So we go to paper straws. PFAS.
Yeah, just like disintegrating into your cup. What? It's such a phenomenon, I think, the whole... The you know response to our plastic problem is to replace straws. I know. And like, you know, you pull up to, I saw on the door of some drive-through, on the window it said you have to request per state guidance, Vermont state guidance, we will not give you a straw, you have to request a straw. I don't know. Like, how do we get people to think rationally? I don't know what to say. You're getting this giant plastic cup. But because you saw an injured turtle, you want you know, the straw is the problem? I don't even know how to deal with that.
Same. Yeah. Again, I it's like behavior and culture change. Like, yeah. We need that. We need people to think differently about the resources. I don't even like that word, resources. It feels so just like here for us to use. We are the only species that destroys our own nest. And we do it repeatedly.
Ew.
And we like to blame others for it. It's us. Mm-hmm. The humans are the problem. And we could change our minds. But I'm afraid that it's going to take insane pain and devastation.
Hardship.
Yeah. Before we change. I mean, honestly, like getting back to super compost, it's one of the reasons that keeps me going with it is like kids are able to realize some agency mm-hmm. that they have and that mm-hmm. they can make a positive difference in this crazy world. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to learn like what are the statistics because all the calculators are different, but like what are we saving in terms of greenhouse gases and water quality for every 10,000 pounds of compost or food scraps diverted. Because most schools waste, you know, between 6 and 20,000 pounds of food a year.
I believe that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Times 20 schools. Yeah. We stand to divert a lot into nutrients. And composting is a bioconcentration as well. So if there are toxins in your compost, you're concentrating those. Mm-hmm. So getting into PFAS, it's a concern, but it's not a reason not to compost.
Exactly, because it's going to be the microbes that help us.
That's right. That's right.
And the, and
and the fungi.
The power of microbes and mm-hmm. yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And there's so much to learn mm-hmm. if we can pay attention mm-hmm. in the ways like that Christine Jones does.
Yeah. Yep. Wow. Soil science in every school with that vision.
Right? Sure. Yeah. Just like introductory soil science. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. soil aggregates are a thing. Yeah. Plants build soil.
It makes so much sense. Like even yesterday hearing Christine or Dr. Jones, it just makes sense in your gut. I was like, I feel like I know all of this to be true. And it's like, yeah, I've probably learned it. Like I have studied this a little, but it just makes intrinsic sense. And I think that's what excites kids too. That's what excited me as a young learner about plants was like, the microbiology that's going on in this world. It just like, it's so astounding. It's so beautiful. And it all just works and makes sense. And it's like supporting you, you know, I just feel like held by that. And it's mm-hmm. very reassuring that I think kids, especially like these new generations are all up in everything's up in the air, literally like in the cloud, you know?
Yeah. You know, there's microbes in the cloud too. They make rain. Those hydroscopic nuclei, they're some of our rainmakers. And they associate with trees, specific qualities of forest, which wow. are fewer and fewer.
Hydroscopic nuclei is my new favorite word.
I learned that one from Walter Yena, another one of my soil gurus that I learned about from Dee Dee.
We almost touched on the kind of fake compostable products. Did you have more to say on that? Or like, is yeah. there any circumstance where those are actually compostable, or do we just not trust the labels?
Well, no. So there are some that are compostable. Mm-hmm. The market is always changing mm-hmm. and it's a lot of greenwashing. Mm-hmm. The plates that look like paper
yeah.
will decompose really quickly.
Yeah.
But if you take 50 of them in a stack and put them in your compost pile, those aren't going to break down because there's no room for air. Mm-hmm. If you can shred them or just put like a few plates in at a time, it's fine. Mm. But like at schools, I tell them not to use them because they're going to produce 200 at a time. Yeah. And then it throws your recipe off. Mm-hmm. So those will break down pretty quickly. Mm. I've never seen any of the utensils break down. A lot of them are corn-based. And they pound the heck out of them so there's no air. Like microbes can't even get in there to break them. Even the teeny tiny microbes, they just it's too much. Mm-hmm. And then again, the volume that we use. Mm-hmm. I mean, a fork a day, like that's crazy. Just back to the metal fork again. Just know that plan to eat.
Right.
Just plan.
Shouldn't come as a surprise to you every day.
You're gonna eat today. Oy. So those, I think I'd rather see people go right for the behavior change than mm-hmm. to substitute. And I mean, what is the footprint of creating these products? You know, we're shipping stuff all around the world. We're in labs, we've got manufacturing, they're shipping, mm-hmm. boxing, all the plastic it's wrapped in, all when you could have just gotten a fork at the thrift store. It mm-hmm. just, it really doesn't make any sense to me, but there are some that are compostable. And if folks want to know more about that, check out the Composting Association of Vermont. Mm-hmm. My colleague, Natasha Duarte, has done a lot to try and make lists accessible and talks, and is always consulting with people that are smart and some that aren't smart, you know, that create these products. So just trying to make sense of it and make it clear what is and what is not accessible. And she's right up with me on the just bring your own fork.
Yeah. Let me solve this problem for you.
Yeah.
Stop producing waste.
Single,
reduce.
Yeah, single reuse, use. Recycle. Single use products. What other species does that?
Yeah, we're special.
Sure are.
Yeah. We haven't had any fun sound effects. Do you have a broken thing that you wish were fixed?
Yeah, PFAS. Let's fix it. Let's make the companies who create these products accountable in a way that does not pass the cost on to consumers mm-hmm. to be accountable for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of PFAS getting sprayed around via herbicides and whatnot.
Yep.
So there's a lot of accountability there.
There's, yeah. We know who's responsible. So what's broken is this system where we just won't hold the largest purveyors of problems accountable, whether it's the uber rich or it's the companies that are producing these mm-hmm. chemicals or products that are destroying our nest. Mm-hmm. We just continually give them a pass because we think they're too big to catch. I don't know. I know Vermont just passed a law mm-hmm. that we're going to try and hold polluters accountable. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading some of the comment threads in newspapers, you know, that mm-hmm. are publishing around this law. And, you know, the main comment is like, this is just going to get passed on to consumers because when companies are fined, they just increase their prices. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, well, then we shouldn't hold them accountable. I that's not the answer. How do we change? So what's broken is like those really big gears at the base of our system. How do we change those? Because mm-hmm. it's time. We got to change them. Mm-hmm. We need accountability. Mm-hmm. We can't, you know, we're fighting over school budgets and we're like kicking our neighbors in the face while Bezos and Gates walk off mm-hmm. with everything. Mm-hmm. And we don't hold them accountable.
Right.
We just blame our neighbors when it's not our neighbor's fault.
Broken.
Don't kick your neighbor in the face.
Don't. It's not recommended. Love your neighbor.
Love your neighbor.
Respect your neighbor. Care for your neighbor.
Be neighborly.
Be neighborly.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming and explaining all this. It was such a pleasure. So many details about the Super Compost Project that I didn't know myself. So now I want to be involved. How can people be involved with you? Do you need volunteers?
Oh, yeah. We need volunteers. There's another thing that's broken, honestly. Yeah. Volunteerism is broken, and I think people feel undervalued, or I don't know what. There's probably a million reasons, but service work feels so good. Mm-hmm. We need it. We're social creatures. We have to help each other. Mm. So, yeah. People can come and volunteer to turn compost piles.
Yeah.
If you want to get paid to do technical service provider work working with schools, you've got to know about composting and how to deliver information to people in a palatable and loving way. Mm-hmm. Then you can come work for our project. If you know where there's waste, like wood chips or sawdust or hay, mm-hmm. Connect because we want to recycle those into local nutrients. I would love for this project to result in a learned community who feels totally in power over their nutrient cycle. Mm-hmm. And so that anyone who wants to grow food has access to really nice compost made in their community of, by, and for the community.
Beautiful. I'm with you. Let's go. I'm so glad we live in a community together.
I know, me too.
You're super inspirational to us. So thank you. I think we should wrap it.
Let's wrap it.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up. Until next time.
And until next time, it's been Broken Vermont with Jen and Kat and Aaron's ghost.
And Aaron's ghost. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron. We love you. Okay. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Broken Vermont podcast with your host, Aaron and Jen.
Jen and Aaron.